Hello, welcome to Inside Science. I'm Tom Whipple, and today we are talking about a possible functional cure for HIV. What does it do? How promising is it? And the really crucial question, what does functional mean? Then, from one terrible pandemic to the most terrible pandemic of all, did the Black Death start because of a volcano thousands of miles away and some enterprising Venetian merchants? And joining me to review the big journal stories of the week, we have Caroline Steele. Caroline, give us a teaser.
So I'm going to talk about why photobombing is an issue in space.
Excellent. I look forward to the aliens getting in shot. This is not a cure. Almost 40 years ago, those were among the first words said about the first treatment approved for HIV. Amid a terrifying pandemic, Robert Windham from the US Department of Health and Human Services told reporters that they had a treatment, a drug called AZT that attacked the virus, but he did not want to overpromise. Four decades on, scientists are still wary of the C word, but patients have a very different experience. Once those infected took daily pills with marginal results and awful side effects. Today they can live near normal lives. And this week, the word cure was used again, albeit preceded by the word functional. In trials, an antibody treatment seemed to enable some patients to control the virus apparently indefinitely. What is it doing, and what does functional mean? I'm joined by Kate Bishop, Principal Group Leader at the Francis Crick Institute. She studies antiretrovirals and their role in treating HIV. Afternoon, Kate. First of all, can you just describe these antibody treatments for us?
Yes, people were given antibodies that recognised a range of different HIV variants. So these are called broadly neutralising antibodies. And I guess we need to go back a step really and just describe what an antibody to HIV is. Like all viruses, HIV has proteins on its surface that it uses to get into target cells to infect them. And these are the things that the antibodies recognise. And basically, antibodies will bind to the virus, and some of them, if they're called neutralising antibodies, will stop that virus being able to infect a new cell.
And how effective was this in the trials? Because it worked for some people, didn't work for others, and was in between for most.
Yes. I have to say, I think this is one of the most promising trials that have come out. But you're right, it didn't work for everybody. One of the things to recognise about HIV is that within one patient, there's not just one virus, there's hundreds of different kinds of virus. So we're used to maybe hearing about variants from things like SARS-CoV-2 and COVID. Well, there's more variation within one person for HIV than there is in the whole world for something like SARS-CoV-2 or flu.
But the people for whom it worked, and let's get to this word functional, so they took this and then months later they were still controlling, I'm using the word controlling the virus. Can you explain to me why this isn't a cure?
So for that, we have to understand how HIV replicates. So one of the key things about HIV that's different from most viruses is that it inserts its genetic material into the host genome. That cell then has a permanent copy of the viral genes in it. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like any other gene in your body. So it's extremely difficult to get rid of. And in fact, the only way we can get rid of it is to kill that cell that's infected. Because of that, we would have to kill every infected cell in the body. And the other problem is that HIV then, once it's infected cells, it becomes dormant. So these cells, although they are harbouring the viral genes, they don't actually make any virus. So then it's extremely difficult to recognise these cells and work out which cells have actually got copies of the virus in them. So in some ways, it's a little bit like cancer. And that's why we don't use this word cure. Like in cancer, they use remission. And so it's similar that we know that there are HIV-infected cells in the body, but we don't necessarily know where they are and we can't really recognise them. And so the word functional cure comes in. We want to be able to have people that don't have to take drugs every day. And where this research was exciting is that these people were given broadly neutralising antibodies. And then even after the antibodies disappeared and they couldn't detect the antibodies in the patients anymore, they were still able to control the virus.
When the virus turned up, when it emerged from these cells, they were attacking it and preventing it from doing anything?
Yes. So if there was virus around, the antibodies would bind it and prevent it infecting any more cells. But there seemed to be an extra thing going on where potentially these antibodies were activating the immune system to try and sort of recognize infected cells and destroy them as well.
We're all now familiar, as you say, with COVID, of talking about antibody treatments and all of these sort of viral things. I think people listening to this will wonder, why 40 years on are we giving people what feels like the obvious thing, an antibody treatment that attacks it? What is it about HIV that actually means that this is so much harder?
There's multiple reasons why it's difficult to make antibodies against HIV. First of all, they're coated in sugars, which are made from the body. So they actually look much more like part of you, and they're not recognized as foreign, which is what we make antibodies against, things that are foreign to us and not ourselves in general. But importantly, HIV mutates all the time. And so every time we make antibodies against HIV, the virus moves on and changes, and those antibodies don't work. These broadly neutralizing antibodies are so important, but they're really difficult to make. Not everybody makes them. So it's taken years, as you say, to isolate these and to characterize them, actually to make them. And then the other thing that they did for this study is they've also stabilized these antibodies, so they make them last longer in the blood. So it's been a sort of gradual process of making these things better and trying to understand them before they can even get to the point of using them.
What does the future look like for HIV? Is there a situation where people are still thinking there might be a cure, there might be a magic bullet, might it even be this thing? Or more pragmatically, are we looking at lots and lots of stuff together?
I think it's going to be a combination. So one thing about this broadly neutralizing antibody treatment is it's very expensive. Also, the antibodies are proteins. They need to be kept cold. They need to be in a fridge, and they need to be delivered by injection. And none of those things are particularly amenable in the field in Africa. The other thing would be these long-acting antiretroviral therapies, where instead of having to take daily medication, you could just have sort of one injection a year, which would also make it a lot easier for people to take their medication. Adherence is one of the main problems. So I think that there will be a combination of different things. Prevention is really important. We still have over 1 million new infections every year. We really need to stop that. And we do have, at the moment, I think we have the means to do things like that. So actually, although we haven't got the means to cure, I think we have got the means to stop transmission. Obviously, most of these things require money, so that's always the issue. But we do have the tools.
Thank you very much. That's Kate Bishop from the Francis Crick Institute. Now, at Inside Science, we are always at the cutting edge. So we begin the next section with a 14th century chronicler.
In the year 1346, on the Feast of the Martyrs, the Great Famine began everywhere, where a cester of wheat, both old and new, was worth 100 souls. The famine lasted until Our Lady of August. In the year 1348, in the month of March, the mortality began in Béziers and lasted until the month of August. The mortality was such that out of every 25 people, barely two or three remained.
First, in 1345, the sky had darkened. There were reports of eclipses. Then the summer didn't come. Crops failed and famine followed. Finally, grain ships came from the east, bringing food and salvation. Or the residents of Italy thought they did. But with the grain they so desperately needed came something else. Rats, fleas, and a little bacterium called Yersinia pestis. Is this how the Black Death began? With me is Ulf Buntgen from the University of Cambridge. He has uncovered a chain of events that began with the eruption of a volcano thousands of miles away in the tropics and ended, he thinks, with a third of Europe dead. Ulf, let's start with the volcanoes. What happened in the early 1340s and how do we know about it?
We honestly don't know really a lot about a volcanic activity up to 800 years ago. There are ice core records both in Greenland and Antarctica, and these record sulfur depositions that can be released from large eruptions. If we find the sulfur signals in the ice cores from Greenland, We would assume that the eruption took place on the northern hemisphere extratropics, if it's in Antarctica, southern hemisphere. And if we find temporally synchronized spikes, so evidence in the same year of sulfur in ice cores from both hemispheres, we would assume it's a tropical one, which was the case in the mid-1340s.
And then you've traced this cluster of eruptions to some bad summers. How did you do that?
In fact, we did it the other way around. We looked into the tree rings on different sites, hundreds and thousands of trees that are growing in different mountain systems in Europe and Scandinavia and also Northern Africa. And they indicated a sequence of up to three consecutive cold summers. And that gave us indication that there might have been volcanic forcings. During the growing seasons of 1345-46, trees were not able to lignify their secondary cell walls and really form a proper ring. So temperatures must have been dropped under a certain threshold that do not allow trees to lignify.
And this is where I guess we move on from your area of geography into, you've co-authored a paper with a historian. Tell me how this then translates to what people were writing and what this chain of events set off.
So there is this link. We want to understand climate variability pre-industrial, so in the past. But then on the other side of the chain reaction, we also want to know what might have been societal consequences. And then I'm usually reaching out to historians. And in this case, I did that with Martin Bauer, who is a medieval historian climatologist. And then he could corroborate these climatic downturns or anomalies.
Talk me through the documentary evidence. What are people saying in the mid-1340s in Europe?
One important thing here is that we can really nail it down to the year and even the season. And that is very, very important. The tree rings are absolutely dated and the historic sources as well. So Martin would look into these and then we see, yes, there is a lot of indication about bad harvest, harvest failures, large-scale famine. And if we see that these sources report reductions in grain productivity, harvest failures at larger scales, so what Martin would call supra-regional or pan-Mediterranean, then we know directly the source or the reason for these harvest declines must have been a climatic one and can't be explained with local factors.
And this is where I guess your paper goes maybe into slightly another discipline. You've got a bit of economics in there. So what happens? We've got harvest failure. You've got accounts of people eating nettles, eating herbs. There's clearly people dying from famine. What happens next?
Italian city-state like Venice, Padua, Pisa, they had established a Mediterranean-wide network of grain supply for the very rare cases that these supra-regional harvest failures occur. And they did it in this case. They put everything to water that could float to import large-scale grain from the northern Black Sea regions via Constantinople and then into Venice and the other ports in the Mediterranean. So the safety net functioned and they could prevent starvation. But ironically, they also imported something no one could know at that time. And one can then very nicely see how Yersinia pestis, the bacterium, was spread over.
Isn't it wonderful that you can look at something happening in a tree and expand it out into all of these other findings?
I think it is. I mean, the trees are not telling us these things, but they contribute to a more comprehensive picture and they provide an environmental and climatological context of what have happened in the past. And we have to be careful to not be deterministic, but these are factors that contribute to decision-making and understanding plague and infectious disease and how climate and society have been interwoven in the past and even today. I think that requires collaboration between different disciplines and the tree rings are just one of them.
So we should remember the lessons of the 1300s. Now, back to the present, and the coasts of Britain are getting a little saltier, a little wetter, and a little squelchier. Your intrepid Inside Science team has put on its wellies and headed west to find out why we are getting more salt marshes. We're going into a field, and it just looks like a field, except the warning sign says deep mud, eroding banks, strong currents, and unpredictable tidal environment. Now, I can't see the sea, I've been told it's 3 kilometres away, but it is nevertheless occasionally an unpredictable tidal environment.
It's easy to forget that this is the new coastline. You can just about see sort of the creek network that brings all the seawater in from the breach, and then you've got the Bristol Channel in front of us. I'm Alice Laver. I work for WWT, the wetland charity, and I'm the site manager for Stuart Marshes in Somerset. I was walked up onto this bank for my interview, and it was a dust bowl. There was no water, no greenery. I couldn't quite get my head around the scale, but also even imagining it becoming a wetland one day.
It looks to me, no offence, like a field. It's better than a dust bowl. In what way is this a salt marsh? What does that mean?
A salt marsh is habitat that's inundated by the tide. But salt marshes, we've lost 80% around our coastline in the UK. So it's actually a really rare habitat because of the plants and the animals it supports. So they are adapted to living in those environments and they need other places to go because of those losses. So that is why this is really important.
So you turned up here 14, 15 years ago and then you wanted to turn it into a salt marsh. Did that involve just letting the sea in and then you just kick back?
Yes, you do. You cut a hole in the old seawall and you let the tide in, but it's really important to manage that and monitor it to make sure that it's developing into the way that it should. Our expertise means that you're going to have a healthy, functioning wetland. If it's designed badly, it can do quite the opposite.
And what was it before then?
It was farmland, so it was really intensively managed. That farmland was in danger of being flooded, so what we've done is sort of manage that risk.
And so this is where you cut a hole in the breach and the water can now do what it wants, and occasionally, even where we're standing now, you've got to watch out for unpredictable tides.
Absolutely, and I mean that's why we thought it's really exciting to have the boardwalk there, because people can actually walk along a pathway and have water on either side of them and really have an immersive experience.
Let's go and immerse.
Yeah, let's go and have a look at some plants. You can start seeing some of the different species that come in. You've got sea aster here with some of the bigger leaves. You've got the bear mud, which is obviously really, really important for birds.
You say obviously birds like mud. Why do birds like mud?
Because that's where you get all your invertebrates.
Yeah, there's a nice little fact about this. About a cubic metre of mud is like 16 Mars bars worth of energy for overwintering birds. I'm Orlando Venn. I'm the Principal Project Officer for Wetland Restoration at WWT. I guess it's only recently, I would say, that we're starting to identify all the services that salt marshes provide, whether it's from a flood protection, carbon sequestration point of view.
Talk us through that a little bit more. So yeah. How does flooding more land give us more protection against floods?
A fully functioning salt marsh should be building over time, depositing material, and essentially that provides a buffer between the defence and the coastline and wave action and storm surges. You know, if we can restore marshes in the correct way, setting back defences, essentially we can improve the flood resilience and protection to communities.
And what about, you mentioned carbon sequestration. Yep. Why is this sequestering carbon and how much? Have you learned anything from this site?
So that carbon, which would be available to the atmosphere and bound to create carbon dioxide, has essentially been locked up within the mud. The organic material, which has been grown in the form of salt marsh plants, and the organic material that comes in with the tides, every time we get the laying down of sediments, on every tide, that is essentially being buried. So tide in, tide out, we've got material being buried, and then we've got the growth of salt marsh plants through that material, and then we've got more sediment going on top. And so it's like sort of building up a big cake, essentially, a big trifle of different layers.
The first 4 years, we've had over a metre of accretion, and we know that that's stored anywhere between 16.5 and 18,500 tonnes of CO2. And that's the same amount of energy used as by 15,000 homes or 2 million trees grown for 10 years. Just here's a perfect example, is where you get the bear mud, the seeds come in, and you can see here we've got the English scurvy grass starting to establish. So with the dynamics and the movements, you get new species moving in.
Can I squelch?
Yeah, go
careful
for it.
When you go.
how far down am I going to go?
Well, we'll let you know.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. I've sometimes done that and gotten a lot further than I thought.
There's some bird tracks.
Out here at this time of year, we'll get sort of curlew, we'll get lapwing, golden plover, dunlin, redshank, all feeding on the mud. It's like a bed and breakfast for birds.
We're here because it's, you know, it's nice to go to a salt marsh, but we're also here because elsewhere along the coast, there's another place that's in the stage that you were at 14, 15 years ago.
Yes, WWT are working on another site in the Severn Estuary. It's an area that would have been salt marsh in the past. We're looking to restore that historic landscape, and in doing so, provide that habitat that we've lost.
Tell us about the site then. What stage is it at, okay, and how did you get it?
The site itself is about 150 hectares. It's currently, if you like, a dry site, surrounded on all sides by a flood defence, but that defence is in quite a poor condition. So the agency have told us, you know, at any point really, it might fail, and that site would actually be inundated in some form. So we're looking to manage that and actually do it in a way that we can create a nice diversity of habitats.
How have the locals taken to your plans?
I think it's fair to say we've had a mixed response, partly because a lot of people don't know what Zotmarsh is. We've had a legacy of sort of taking the Zotmarsh from the sea, claiming it, draining it, and then putting it to agriculture use. So it has been used for many generations for farming. And I guess what we're also trying to do is, in our design of the site, also look for a future there where we have got some grazing on the site.
And have you bought the land? Have farmers sold you the land for this?
Yes, they have, yeah. Talking certainly to one of the farmers, they used the phrase, this is a ticking time bomb. So they had a realisation that there would be change coming, that they were at risk. If it did breach, it would be difficult for them to farm. Obviously, the value of the land would go down from an agricultural point of view. You know, we're not building a supermarket. We're not putting solar panels all out on the site. Hopefully, we're providing a resource which will be something that the local community can enjoy into the future as well.
Our thanks to Orlando Venn and Alice Laver. Caroline Steele is here for the review of the rest of the week's science. Caroline, what else is there?
So I want to start by talking about a photobomber. So I'm going to show you a photo, and then could you describe it? And I want you to guess what or who is photobombing. Okay, you ready? I'm going to turn my laptop round.
I am having a look at, that's definitely space.
Correct.
There's lots of spacey things.
Yeah.
There is a big line across the top left-hand corner obscuring a beautiful, I'm going to say, nebula, but I know that space doesn't have big straight lines. Ah, is it a satellite
in
time-lapse photography?
Perfect, 10 points. That is a satellite sort of obscuring an image from a space-based telescope. So, according to a paper published in Nature this week, 96% of images from space-based telescopes could be spoiled by satellites in the next decade, which is a huge problem because it makes these images much less useful to scientists. And telescopes in space are really important because, unlike telescopes on the ground, they don't sort of get influenced by Earth's atmosphere. So they're incredibly valuable to scientists. But they share a sort of world with satellites because they both orbit Earth, which means that when satellites get in the way and reflect light that sort of interferes with the image is spoiled. And that's a big problem because, so in 2019, there were only 2,000 satellites in orbit. Now we have 15,000. And scientists in this study basically looked at a database of planned launches and found that we're likely to see as many as 560,000 satellites launched in the near future. And that would contaminate 40% of NASA's Hubble Space Telescope's images.
This is essentially intractable, though, isn't it? I mean, there's a massive commercial imperative to put these up, and that's going to win out over the astronomers.
Some companies are looking to fix this. So SpaceX and other companies have tested some solutions like covering up satellites with a thin, dark film so they reflect less light. But actually, it didn't work very well. And some of the satellites just heated up and were damaged. So that's not really a solution. If we could somehow make it happen, you could move satellites lower in Earth's orbit. But then you've got the issue of satellites interfering with Earth's ozone layer. I personally think the kind of only realistic solution is to just launch fewer satellites and actually clean up after ourselves. Because, you know, at the moment we have millions of pieces of space junk orbiting Earth. And some of that is retired satellites, which are just orbiting Earth and not actually doing anything. So we should be getting them back down.
Okay, now I'm going to move on to my journal choice. It's actually from a meeting of the Acoustical Society of America. Now, I should say to listeners, we don't know what people have chosen, so this is interactive for you as well. I'm going to require you, Caroline, to dance. And listeners can use their discretion and see whether they want to dance as well. But we're going to play some sounds.
Oh, gosh. OK, so can I do whatever dance I like?
Whatever, that's
exactly
the point.
I'm going to get out of my chair.
Caroline is doing some good bopping here, good hand movements, and up and down. Oh, and we're pointing to stars. This is very, very Saturday Night Fever. Okay, now you're not finished. Stay up, stay up.
Oh, gosh, okay. Oh, I don't know if the lights are slow.
Oh, there we go. I could imagine you with your lighter swaying slightly to this one. Caroline, you have done exactly what you should.
Oh, really?
So
oh,
there
good.
Is a meeting of the Acoustical Society of America, and they have been looking at what makes people go up and down and bop, as you did with the first.
Yeah.
And what makes people sway, as you did with the second. And composers were asked to compose music that fitted these criteria without really knowing why, and validated in this N of one and N of all of the listeners that indeed it does do the bopping versus the swaying. It seems like percussive sounds and a beat make listeners go up and down, whereas slower, more mellow atmospheric music makes you sway.
Oh, that's so strange. Why do we do that? I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's instinctive. Is it something that we've learnt from each other?
I mean, I could make up something about cavemen around a fire involving hitting gourds of something, but honestly, not
yeah.
a clue.
Very interesting. And I'm glad I did what the science said and didn't go completely rogue.
Exactly. So are we interactive with your final story?
Okay, final story. Plastic can be programmed to have a lifespan of days, months or years rather than taking centuries to break down. This is according to a paper published in Nature Chemistry recently, which is very exciting because obviously we have vast amount of plastic to deal with. And depressingly at the moment, only about 14% of plastic is recycled. Now, a little bit of chemistry. So plastic is a polymer, which basically means it's a molecule made up of repeating smaller units. And scientists at the State University of New Jersey wondered why natural polymers, like DNA, break down quite easily, whereas synthetic ones, like plastic, just don't. And the reason is natural polymers like DNA have these structures in them called neighbouring groups that basically help break down the polymer at the end of its life. So scientists, I think this is pretty impressive, basically created their own artificial neighbouring groups, added them to the plastic, and it worked. The plastic now breaks down. And you can alter the neighbouring group to change, does it break down in 10 days? Does it break down in 10 months? Does it break down in 10 years? So you can kind of time
its
self-destruction.
So it still has the thing that makes plastic good, which is durability.
Exactly. And... which is, yeah, really cool, but hopefully it won't last for centuries. Of course, there are some shortcomings. So it's better for not structural things. And there's a couple of problems to solve before it can be used commercially. Like when the plastic's broken down, it forms a kind of liquid. We need to check we can release that into the environment or use it to make new plastics. And also this sort of destruction of the plastic needs sunlight. So if stuff ends up in landfill, it won't work. But this is sort of the thing that's excited me most in the world of plastic for a very long time.
Well, look, exciting plastic is a wonderful place to end, but it's not only plastic that has a built-in end of life, so does every episode of Inside Science, and ours has come to an end now. That's it. It's goodbye from me, and it is goodbye from Caroline.
Goodbye.